Hi, welcome to the Ultimate Music Recommendation Smackdown panel. The title might actually be a little bit misleading. We were exchanging some emails, and it turned out that these people don't really hate each other as much as I thought they might. And they just started kind of singing Kumbaya in the green room, and so it might be more hand-holding, I think, than smacking down.
Except for Ollie, who chimed in with, can't we just all not get along?
Right. He wanted controversy. Who are you, by the way?
Good question. So my name is Colin Brumel. I'm an independent developer living in San Francisco. I write a music blog at mixedcontent.com, and I'm very honored to be on this panel with these illustrious people. To my left here is Martin Stitzkel from Last.fm, based out of London. To his left is Matthew Dunn from Music IP. And down there is Tom Conrad from Pandora, based in Oakland, San Francisco, California. And Ali Partovi from iLike, based in Seattle. So I'm going to start with some background here. When people ask, what is a music recommendation system, there's kind of a few different ways you can look at this. In my mind, there's kind of two main purposes of the music recommendation system. One is to help people find music. You know, you're interested in a particular track. You're looking for somebody to help filter music out for you. You're looking for someone to help find music for you. Another purpose is, if you're an artist, you want to help people find your music. So an analogy that I always like to use is that of the guy at the local music store that knows your tastes perfectly. You can walk into that store and you can say, what's new, and this guy knows because you've bought music from him before, you've been there before, he knows you, and so he can recommend music that you might like. At the same time, if you're a band, you might go in and say, hey, here's my new demo tape, give it to your customers you think might like me. And I think that's what all the software that these people here produce kind of mimics in a certain sense here. But why is that important? What's wrong with that guy in the store? Why do we need to have software to help facilitate this process at all? And I think there's several things. The first of all is that I think right now there's incredible changes happening in the music world, massive transformations. And so one of these several kind of huge events is the cost of recording music has dropped dramatically. So in the past, you would have to go to a studio. This one's in Toronto, costs $1,200 a day. And you need to have labels to finance it. And it's a very expensive proposition to record an album. But now, all you need is a nice laptop, some microphones, and away you can go. So the cost of recording music has dropped dramatically. At the same time, the cost of music distribution has dropped dramatically, too. In the past, you had trucks. You have to load them up with CDs that you print at plants. You drive them to record stores that are probably going to go out of business pretty soon. And you have to stock shelves, all that stuff. Very expensive. But now, anybody can record a piece of music on their laptop, put it on MySpace, and instantly you have global distribution of a cheap, a cheaply produced thing. And so I think together the cheap production of music and the cheap distribution of music has led to a huge explosion of available content. And so we're literally awash in music these days. And so it's a fantastic time to be a music fan. In fact, I don't think there's ever been a better time to be a music fan. I mean, there's so much stuff that's so readily available. And it doesn't stop there, though, right? You have things like the iPod, of course, which, so not only is there all this music, but you have incredible access to this music. You can have, 80 gigabytes in your back pocket. And we've never had anything like that before, that's for sure. And so, and it's only going to get worse or better, depending how you look at it. But, Moore's Law, of course, says that the size of a hard drive doubles every 2 years. And it's kind of held true. It's not a scientific fact, it's more kind of an empirical observation. But, so if you ascribe to the fact that Moore's Law is going to hold for a few more years, you get things like by 2015, you'll have a 1 terabyte iPod in your back pocket. And Yeah, that's a lot of music, right? But that's nothing. I mean, and this is a bit ridiculous, but if you kind of extend this out, you know, by around 2025, you'll have, you know, around 77 years of uninterrupted listening. So you're getting kind of close to the lifespan of a human, where your choice to listen to any particular track is an active choice not to listen to something else. I mean, this is a bit facetious, but I mean, the point is that there's so much music. How do you find that song that speaks to you in this sea of content? How do you find, that track that, you know, really hits home and you can empathize with? And conversely, if you're an artist, how do you find audience for your music when there's so much competition, when you're literally just, you know, there's infinite choice at your fingertips? How do you find an audience for your music? And so these are tough questions, and I'm glad that these four people have been working diligently to solve and answer these questions. And here they are. Here's the solution. So now I'd like to try to ask a few questions, get some discussion happening here. But that's kind of the basic background for music recommendation, what music recommendation systems are. So first of all, I wanted to get each person to introduce their own service and how it works. By the way, we kind of thought that was a bit boring. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to have each person introduce somebody else's service. Just kind of twist it up a bit, right? So
with time for rebuttal, right?
With time for rebuttal. So if there's any corrections or false claims, they'll be corrected. So first up, I'd like to have Pandora introduce iLike. So. Yeah. So Tom, go for it.
As I understand it, iLike is a recommendation site for women's clothing that uses photographic recognition. That's iLike, right? Now, iLike is a social network that starts with a extension to iTunes, watches the things that you interact with and play in that environment, and then automatically and really quickly creates a profile for you at iLike.com that you can share with your friends. They'll recommend music to you from the GarageBand.com library, which they've been building since 1999. Is that right? I think the thing that I like the best about iLike is it's just really beautifully designed, and I think they've made a lot of really, really good decisions about the particular problems they're going to solve and the problems that they're just not going to touch for now. And I think that takes a ton of discipline to decide what not to do. And I think they've really struck a really nice balance between, creating a site that's really functional easy to use and not overloaded it with features that some small segment are interested in. It's a great place to discover music and meet people who have similar tastes. They also have this awesome thing where they dynamically calculate your sort of musical compatibility with someone else on the site. And so they kind of solve this problem that all of us face in the social context when you sort of land on someone's page. It's maybe been recommended by the system, hey, you have similar musical taste to this other person. They've got this sea of musical data. You kind of scratch your head and go, well, why do they think I'm like this person? And they have these great features to kind of pull that out and, in fact, let you click over to a list of the songs that this other person has that you don't have, which is a great discovery tool I found.
I'm really going to have to rebut that hard. I mean, that was a scathing critique.
No, I'm not sure if there's anything to rebut on that. Thank you for the very nice description.
You can start singing Kumbaya anytime here.
Exactly. The one thing I would say is when we created iLike, our goal was to have a combination of computer-based recommendations and friend-based recommendations. So the computer tells me I'm going to like this song, or some friend that I invited to the site and linked to tells me. And we found that we really weren't sure which is going to be more compelling, and we found that the friend base is actually what people spend a lot more time on and get more value out of, which is somewhat the logical thing. I think people have always discovered music through their friends, and technology to facilitate that, I think, is largely lacking. I mean, I think we've only scratched the surface, but considering that people consider MySpace to be a music discovery place, and there's, it's really discovery by complete random chance, I think there's a lot of room to improve friend-based music discovery. And I would say that's one of the areas that which we consider our core focus.
Great. Would you like to introduce Music IP now?
Sure. Music IP, like I think many of the companies on this represented here, is a company that's evolved over the years. But it's a company that offers. It's based on a core recommendation technology, based on looking at actual facets of individual songs, and you know, essentially saying if you like this, you like this other thing because of underlying elements of the music itself. And they bring that to market via both a consumer software that you can actually install on your computer that'll create playlists for you or that'll play music, help you with the music selection process. So, you know, rather than getting stuck in a rut where you play the same, you know, one album over and over, which I certainly find myself doing on my iPod, essentially it helps you explore your own music library better by helping you, you know, help following the interrelationships between songs. So that's a consumer software. They also have a B2B business where they offer the recommendation technology as a service to other companies, you know, to enhance, you know, their consumer services.
Close? Kumbaya, man. So I would add just one thing to that, which is that core technology for music identity and music relationship that we developed over a lot of years, we also built to run on consumer electronics devices. And you mentioned the 1 terabyte iPod, and that's a problem that is showing up already. I mean, 80 gigs of music is a lot of music to listen to, and we also license the technology to make consumer devices capable of push the button, get a playlist. And they're on the market now, finally, happy to say. But thank you.
In fact, do you happen to have one of those devices with you?
Yeah. I'll do a demo later, but I want to talk about Martin first. Because that's
indeed
more important.
Please go. Yeah.
Cool. So Last.fm, my view of Last.fm, one, a huge community of people who are interested in music, who care enough about what they listen to on their desktop to essentially log that on a constant basis. You guys get, I believe I heard the figure, half a billion Scrabbles a month, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, terrific amount of traffic. So Last.fm is a community for people who are music fans. Gives them a place to encounter people with similar tastes. And as I think Tom said when we were discussing this in the green room, it lets you be a bit of a voyeur and realize that not all of your friends actually have the same musical taste that you do, which is a very important discovery. In addition, Last.fm provides a desktop player that plays music that's essentially generated out of that massive data set of what all of those Last.fm fans are listening to. So in that sense, they are a terrific internet radio service with a very, very broad canvas for discovery. Did I miss anything?
No, it was pretty good kumbaya description. Last.fm is very much about your music profile. We try to capture everything that you listen to, wherever you listen, even to some of the other services. Right. Everything can get logged into your music profile, and that's really the key for your whole experience there. We use that information to hook you up with other people that like the same music, to find you other music that you should check out too, to find you free music that is uploaded by our participating record labels and artists, and find you concerts in your area where you should go to. So it's a very rich music experience, sort of like implicit in the name, really. Last.fm set out to be the last music platform you'll ever need. There's a lot, music is very fragmented on the net. There's a lot of different places you have to go to really get information about music, to get to listen to music, to maybe buy a ticket or buy a CD. Last.fm is pooling all this information. We also have a massive music catalog, which is essentially built up by our listeners. They tell us whenever there's a new song, we create a page, and we have over 65 million different tracks in our database from all over the place, and trying to recommend this to the right people.
Good. And now, now it's your turn to introduce Pandora.
Pandora is a recommendation radio station. You go to the page. It's a very slick and slim user experience. Sorry, not slim in the sense of that there isn't much, but it's very well designed for what it does. You type in an artist name, and Pandora tries to play you other music that they think is similar to that track or that artist you just typed in. Now, how they categorize the music, they have a bunch of experts sitting in an ivory tower listening to every track for about 20 minutes or 40 minutes. I can't remember how long is it, roughly thereabouts. And ticking a lot of boxes, trying to categorize the music based on the Music Genome Project, which I think consists of 400 or 700 different properties. They range from mildly syncopated to female vocal, and this way they're trying to match up music. So you get a good discovery experience by starting with a point that you know, and then off you go and you discover a lot of music that you've never heard before.
Well, for those of you who have been to Oakland, you'll know there are no ivory towers of any kind. Actually, no towers of any kind in Oakland. Yeah, I think that gives a good high-level overview. I mean, it is true that the company has been, for 7 years now, building this thing we call the Music Genome Project, where we've hired professional musicians, the kind of people who are out gigging at South by Southwest Music, to come in during the day when they're not touring and sit down, listen to music one song at a time, and analyze each piece of music across 400 different musicological dimensions. So not just are there guitars, but what kind of guitars, how are they played, what's their role in the overall composition of the song. And we use that information as one of the ingredients in our playlist building. The thing that isn't talked about as much, not that we're shy about it, it just doesn't seem to get discussed, is we sort of equally embrace the social dimension of music. In the, you know, the Pandora player, as you listen, you're able to give thumbs up and thumbs down. You're able to create up to 100 different stations and put multiple musical seeds and starting points into the stations. And we use all of that data to help us understand the social connections in music as well. So one of the things that just popped out of that data the other day was that a connection between iron and wine and the postal service. Well, musicologically, the Music Genome Project would never be able to surface that, but people who are fans of the postal service or fans of Iron and Wine are likely to know that they both were on the Garden State soundtrack. And so by looking at how people are combining things on Pandora and what they're giving thumbs up and thumbs down to, we're able to bring that data into the playlist algorithm as well. And so our really the thing that we believe is that the most powerful sort of approach is one that's inclusive of all of these different kinds of dimensions, not just the musicological, but also the social.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of stuff hiding below the surface on Pandora. We have profiles and ways for people to share music with each other and all kinds of artist, album and song information, song samples, discographies, all that stuff. But very little of that is apparent from the homepage. And the Pandora design philosophy is kind of show the tip of the iceberg and let people discover these other things over time.
Yeah, I mean, you were just touching on that right now, and I think this might be a good kind of discussion question to start off here. But I've heard it referred to as the nature versus nurture debate. The fuzzy warmth of social recommendation versus the analytical approach, and maybe just like how the nature versus nurture debate is itself kind of silly, perhaps this debate is kind of not that relevant at all. But I mean, would you like to comment? I mean, because everybody here kind of approaches it from very different perspectives, and Last.fm, is based entirely on social data. Where Matthew, it's like an algorithm that churns through your music collection. And
well, just a clarification for us, the algorithmic analysis of music that Ali mentioned is certainly IP that we spent a lot of years developing. We also incorporate. Social data, not quite in the same form that these guys get a hold of, but that factors into how we try to surface music that someone's going to like. I mean, I'll take a first cut at the nature versus nurture debate, and I think this was a mail thread I had going with Paul Lemaire, who was unable to join this conference. The domain that social recommendation falls in structurally is generally called collaborative filtering. Fair description?
Yeah, right.
And a lot of you may be familiar with it if you buy books on Amazon. You know, people who bought this also bought that. People who listen to this tend to listen to that. And it's a great mechanism. It certainly proved itself out. That was the initial observation from the famous Longtail article in December 2004. There are strengths and weaknesses to collaborative filtering. Collaborative filtering doesn't surface a brand new song until there's a statistical critical mass. I mean, she may have made something that's gorgeous that we're all going to love, but it'll take a while to work its way up there. It's got to get a statistical toehold. And then on the other end of the scale, if something becomes wildly popular, it's actually problematic. Every page I get on Amazon tells me that I should get the Da Vinci Code because it's wildly popular. It's wildly popular, self-fulfilling prophecy. So I view multiple methodologies as balancing, if you will. I mean, there are times when algorithmically what we do, what Pandora does, may surface a brand new piece of music immediately. And then if it takes off from there, because really the ultimate arbiter is you. You're going to listen to something and you're going to decide whether or not you like it. All of these mechanisms and even your circle of friends are means to that end.
I mean, comments? Looking for a second at the long tail article, the example that Chris Anderson gives in the beginning of that piece of writing is he talks about the book Into Thin Air, which is wildly popular, and it kind of saving the continued publication of a book called Crossing the Void. Mm-hmm. And he sort of like paints this pretty dramatic picture of Crossing the Void, been out for 10 years, almost out of print, no audience at all, and suddenly through the magic of collaborative filtering, it has escalated to popularity. So I was having dinner with Chris, and I said, okay, there's something about that example that I don't understand. I don't understand how a collaborative filtering algorithm could take something that has so little sales volume that it's about to go out of print and make the statistical connection to Into Thin Air. Like, I just don't understand how that would work. And he said, well, that's not what happened. What actually happened was that Crossing the Void was often mentioned in reviews of Into the Void. So that it really was a kind of expert analysis that drew that initial connection, which put enough sort of grist into the statistical mill to start to surface it in the collaborative filtering algorithm. And that's part of how I think about what Pandora does is we can sort of kickstart the system by doing this musicological analysis so that we can make connections when there's really no sales volume or listening volume. Mm-hmm. I think the other challenge for music is that, at least from my perspective, you know, playlist building is the really interesting problem in the mass market. How do we construct a really pleasing sequence of songs? And because artists have if you start to look at it closely, they have any individual artist has a wide range of things that they do musically. And so the unit that you really want to start tracking is you want to start tracking relationships between songs, not between artists. And that just makes it all the more challenging to get enough sort of statistical data to be able to make those connections so that you can figure out sort of song by song what things work together and what things don't. Some maybe easier to figure out that Massive Attack and Portishead tend to share the same fans, but to go down to the song level and to try to connect things up in a pleasing playlist, I think is harder. You know, I think Last has been able to prove through the massive amounts of data that they're able to tap into that it can be done, but it's a hard problem. And there was a period where, you know, on Last, I think you'd concede that all paths led to Radiohead, and that's largely evaporated in the last couple of years. But I know that at least in my experience with it, you know, you could start from almost any point and very quickly get to a Radiohead recommendation. Which is the other challenge is that your community of users, you know, influences the kind of recommendations you make. And so if you start with a particular niche, maybe the indie rock niche or the electronica niche, you can run into those kinds of problems.
If I can say something, I think your example about people who like a book on Amazon like this other book, if anything, it shows that Amazon's system has difficulty because they don't have enough volume of data. You know, an out-of-print book might still be being read by a lot of people who bought it 10 years ago, but Amazon has no way of tracking that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point.
And I think the technology that both iLike and Last.fm employ is that of watching what you're listening to on your computer. And iLike also syncs up when you, whatever you listen to on your iPod, it picks up that data as well when you sync your iPod with your computer. So you might have bought a song 10 years ago, or frankly, you might have acquired it via some other means 10 years ago. But if you listen to it, we register that data, and so does Last.fm. And as a result, even though iLike is only a four-month-old company, and you know Last.fm is certainly younger than Amazon, we both have, I think, significantly better data than Amazon for making those correlations and thereby figuring out something is similar to something else without relying as much on... I mean, the way I think of it, in my opinion, every consumer is an expert. You know, if I love a certain song and I love another song, who's to say that my personal tastes are less you know, less relevant than someone in your ivory tower.
But
no, I'm just teasing. You know, the point is the principle of collaborative filtering, whether you implement it right or not, the idea is that let every consumer have a vote and let each person's personal taste and personal expertise kind of count toward the whole. I think the devil's in the details of how to prevent sort of a
Radiohead problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Or postal service
the majority or whatever. Yeah. As with any democratic system, you got to make sure you've got proper voting process or proper way of counting who's, you know.
Voting machines.
Exactly.
I think it's really about tapping into the knowledge of the crowd. I think the more people you use as an input, and Last.fm uses a variety of input. Sure, there is all the play count information that we're getting from all the 27 different media players and hardware players we're supporting, including the iPod and a bunch of other ones. But there's also other means for users to express their opinion about music. They can tag music based on genre or mood, and that's also a very interesting way to connect music. Based on the genre, potentially, that was invented essentially by music journalists to sell music easier. But what we see at Last.fm is we have Monday morning tags and Christmas tags and things like this, where people listen to at certain times of the day or whatever mood they're in. I think one other issue that is, I think there's sort of like a bit of the smackdown coming out now, which is this very much nurture versus nature debate. The expert opinions always depend on you getting hold of that file. If you don't have it, you cannot analyze it, and you cannot listen to it, and cannot categorize it.
Not necessarily.
Well, tell me then, some Chinese music, how are you going to get hold of it if you don't have it?
We've done the algorithmic analysis that we do on 28 million pieces of music because some consumer in China has that piece of music. And we used some of their CPU time to do that analysis.
Mm-hmm. And how are you keeping up to date with new things that are coming out? I read recently that there's about 50,000 songs released each and every month.
Same way you are. Consumers have them.
Right. So you have... Oh, right. Okay. Well, that's one of the things. Okay.
Yeah, we don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah. In the ivory tower is too small for all that music.
I mean...
returns as well, right, Tom?
Well, so for us... I mean, one thing that's really different about our sort of whole approach to this is that 2.5 years ago when we set out to figure out what kind of consumer company do we want to be, for a long time we had built sort of infrastructure technology for other music companies like Music IP does today. And we looked at a whole bunch of things, including some things that are closer to what Last and iLike are doing. And candidly, I think if it had been my decision as to the path that we would have gone down, I would have built something more like iLike or more like Last. I mean, that's in many ways that's the product that I wanted, and I'm glad we didn't because they've done a tremendous job at it. And I don't think the world needs another one. But the insight that we had was that we looked at how people actually consume music, and here in the U.S., people listen to 17 hours of radio a week. They listen to 3 hours of music they own or have stolen. 2 years ago when we got started, the number of people that in the U.S. that listened to internet radio was about equal to the number of people who owned all MP3 players combined. So it's this kind of sleeper hit. Certainly in many ways was not on my radar. I mean, Rusty is here from Soma FM, which was a sort of inspiration to me in that time. But outside of Soma, I knew very little about the world of internet radio, even though there were tens of millions of people listening. And so we really set out to build a service that was a kind of lean-back experience, a purely listening experience that you could, with the smallest amount of inputs possible, create something that played, we hope, exclusively music that you'll like, create different stations for different moods. And so we were a radio station. I mean, we had these other things that are under the surface, but we're a radio station. And something that every radio station has to deal with at some level is, what is the quality bar that's required to get played for the audience for that particular kind of music? And so... this affects, we have about half a million songs that we play. And clearly the universe of music is much larger than that. And this cuts sort of across all different scales of music publishers. So you take the band Chicago. I think they put out their 30th record this year. I'm pretty confident that not even the most passionate Chicago fan wants Pandora to play every single song that Chicago has ever recorded. I mean, there were certainly dark periods for Chicago. And so there is a editorial role that we play that we do embrace, that where we are constantly looking for great music to play. But the worst thing that we could do for our listeners is play music that there is no audience for. And so that means that, you know, when we find, you know, a new German death metal CD by virtue of people requesting it or sending it to us, we listen to it and ask ourselves, you know, in the context of other, you know, German death metal, does this make the collection better or worse? You know, and our frame on it is always looking for excuses to put it in, but there's plenty of stuff that we don't put in. And so, you know, absolutely, we don't have every song that Last has. I think in the context of our listening service, that serves us pretty well.
But what about the German heavy metal fan? He wants maybe to hear it. I mean, it's very difficult. If you're a music fan, you want to get as much as possible from a certain genre. You don't want to be limited to a few.
And the German heavy metal fans will start stations from that band in Pandora and will then absolutely buy them. If there's a demonstrated demand for that artist, they go in. There's no editorial voice. The song goes in. So, and it takes a very low, you know, bar. I count on one hand, you know, the number of requests we get for a band that we'll put in. But, you know, so if you get four or five requests for an artist, the artist goes in. It's really the ones who have never been requested or have been requested, you know, just, you know, a couple of times that go through this kind of quality.
Well, actually, Tom, how do artists get into Pandora? And I'd like to open that up to all of you, because the vector that artists get their music into your system, in some cases it requires very little effort, in some cases maybe some small effort, but maybe if we can just talk about that for a minute. How do artists get their music into your system?
So we have people whose full-time job it is to scour the earth looking for great new music. So there's people here this week at the festival doing that. Tim tours around the country, our founder, going to small venues, listening to bands.
Ruthless job. Ruthless.
Ruthless. Tim is ruthless. Yeah, yeah. He's a pretty great human being. We have people who scour MySpace for things that are breaking on MySpace. We get hundreds of submissions from our listeners every single day on CD shipped to us. We watch all of the search queries that go into Pandora, and we buy the things that people are searching for. And we have, you know, people who scour things like Pitchfork and all of the charts. And, you know, we're really, our goal there is to really have every piece of music that has found an audience. And that's really the bar that we set, is that you just have to have demonstrated some ability to connect with listeners.
Okay. LastFM really started originally as a platform for unsigned artists and bands. I think our genesis is slightly similar to iLike in this respect. We set up an unsigned artist and band platform in 1999 where unsigned artists and bands could upload their music, and we had a stream. And after a short while, we basically realized that if you don't know anything about the music, nobody else can find it. And that's what eventually led us to build LastFM. So we have a very, very strong artist and label background, and there is a part to LastFM site whereby artists and labels can go there, upload their music, put a cover image, also link it to their favorite online store. And if it's totally unknown, to overcome the starting cold start problems from collaborative filtering that do exist, I agree, they can give it a starting point. So they can type in similar artists or a tag or something like this, and once it starts bouncing around, it gets recommended to other people that like similar music and so on and so forth. So it gets traveling. As a thank you, we give people back the opportunity to check out the statistics, to see what other music their music is really similar to. And if they give us the music for free, meaning for free download or free on-demand preview, full-length preview, we push it even more to our users. So the record label or the artist has the choice to go for more promotion and essentially make music available for free, and then we push it more to our users.
Yeah. Thanks for teeing up that question, Colin. I'm just curious, how many of you in the audience are musicians or work with record labels or something like that? Just want to get a, okay, half, give or take. Yeah, I mean, I'll make the obvious comment. please avail yourself of all of us, because all of us in some way, shape, and form are trying to help you get heard and get found and find your fan base. Music IP is fundamentally a technology licensing company, but we're pretty enthusiastic about this space. And so very similar to what Martin described, we provide a form for you to upload, let us analyze, and if you want Creative Commons license and share and redistribute your music, if not, we'll throw it away when we've analyzed it. But we want, where possible, to help you get your stuff discovered. Our outreach for that is the roughly 50 million desktops that our desktop technology sits on. So it's not a bad window to a bunch of consumers.
It's very interesting. What are there any sort of main consumer brands that use the technology? Because I'm actually not familiar. Which, when you say 50 million, where's the
you heard of a little app called Winamp?
Yes, of course.
Been around a while.
Yeah.
AOL licensed our technology and put it in Winamp. We also distribute our own desktop application, and we've got 5 additional desktop licensees. So we're starting to show up in more places. You know, and as a licensor of technology, that's great.
Probably the one dimension that I didn't touch on to the way our process works is that we, with the exception of the things that are submitted to us directly by artists, we purchase all of the music that we play. So every song you hear on Pandora is on a physical CD in our office that we paid retail price for, and we're obligated to do that under the law in the U.S. So we have a gigantic library of purchased music.
And now you're going to pay even more.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
That's opening a whole Pandora's box, huh?
It may be a bit Pandora-centric to discuss, since we're the one who focuses the most on the radio problem. But
sure.
Just should say.
Well, I mean, another interesting question that I have for all you guys is that I think for the first real time, we have a chance to get stats on what people are actually listening to rather than what people are purchasing. So In the past, you'd get like the top 10 hits, but it's not the top 10 what people are listening to. It's what they're buying. They might buy it, listen to it once, and throw it in the garbage. And so now you actually have a list of what people are listening to. And do you see that changing how music's promoted or marketed or produced?
Fundamentally.
I think all the factors that you counted there in your introduction really fundamentally changed music. It's the best time for music fans for sure, because you can get all sorts of music at any time of the day anywhere on this planet. Whereas before, you had to go and see him, and not everybody lives in a town where there is somebody like him. So it's, I think that is definitely the case. And also the things you said about the coming down in price of technology. To produce music itself as well. Now you can produce music with a sophistication which was only available to Pink Floyd on your laptop. So all these things definitely contributed. And I think to see how well your music is received as well can give you cues. It helps record labels enormously to decide, for example, if you're strung out on a thin budget and you get 3 great demos and you don't know which one to go for. You can put them onto Last.fm, and within a short time you see what's most popular. You even see like what would be the natural single, which is the most popular track. It can also help you to adjust your whole marketing strategy. You have a band which, I don't know, doesn't really fit in. Again, you can submit it to one of these systems and it will tell you what sort of like is similar and what other people listen to in conjunction with your music. So all this feedback that is coming out of these play counts, and all this user submitted data is extremely helpful.
Do you think that it's indicative of the music buying audience at large, or is it kind of like the subset? I mean, is it music fans that this is representative of, or is it just music fans who are internet savvy?
I think to a certain extent, of course. I mean, you have to have a broadband connection, a computer to participate in Last.fm. Otherwise, you can't really do it.
But in these test cases, are the results valid? I mean, like, so when someone tests a single and it does well in Last.fm, does it go on to...
Oh, yes. I think it's way more valid than just asking a bunch of music journalists or music experts, because it taps into the knowledge of the music fans, and they are ultimately the ones. I think, as you said, we're doing the first time in a position to look at how people really listen to music. This used to be done by the gatekeepers, by the DJs, by the VJs. and they are representing a sort of like a small sector of the people really listening to music.
Right. There's a couple of points I think implicit in your question, Colin, which is a good one to surface. One is the push down of professionalism in the business of making and selling music. I mean, there was a time in the past when it was big labels who had access to data, to Arbitron reports and things like that, who would make the very narrowed buying decisions and influencing decisions that determine what got sold and what was a hit. Blow that up. What you need to think about all of us and the data we can feed back to you in the way that someone needs to think about Google and AdWords. You've got access to the business data you need to help your music get found, get furthered, and it's up to you to avail yourself of it.
I was just going to say, when I think about this data, that's sort of two reactions. On the one hand, I think that there's tremendous opportunity for musicians and musician marketers to help figure out a potential audience for their music. In fact, that's why we started the company, is to sort of grease the rails and help audiences find music that they'll like and help artists find their audience. So that's great, and certainly we like to see our data get put to the same kinds of uses that Martin described. On the other hand, I think that I personally think that there are enough music charts in the world. Pandora doesn't need to kind of contribute to that particular kind of popularity contest. You'll never see a chart on Pandora that shows you the most listened to artists, the most popular artists, the things that the Pandora community at large thinks you should be listening to. Because I think we're entering into an era of much more kind of personal media, narrowcast media where everything is focused really on your preferences. And, we get these amazing emails and other correspondences from listeners who are outside of the sort of the musical in crowd, people who write in and say, I'm, 84 years old and have felt disconnected from music since I was, in college or high school, and have been able to reconnect with music in a way that's just been completely absent from my life. And we get letters like that every single day. There was a woman, we did these meetups around the country to meet people who listen to Pandora, and where 200 or 300 people will turn up to talk to us about the things that they hate about Pandora, the things they love about Pandora. And I was at one recently where a woman stood up, and she's probably in her mid-50s, and she started talking about listening to gospel music on Pandora. And started to just weep. I mean, she was crying because of what a change it had made in her life to be able to discover gospel music that she didn't know was out there. And so I think a lot about her as we design and evolve Pandora and try not to slip into thinking about myself. I mean, I'm the guy who likes to go to, Amoeba Records and spend 3 hours on a sunny Saturday afternoon combing the aisles and talking to the tattooed guy behind the counter about what cool stuff I should be listening to. Like, that's all good, but there are venues for those kinds of people already, and there are a lot of different disenfranchised folks out there that I think we can help.
Most of them, actually.
You don't lose your love of music when you get older. You lose the social network. You lose the time. And so a big part of what we're trying to do is to make sure that everybody has, music in their life.
If I can say, I think there are two shifts happening. The original question, Colin, was about changes in the landscape as far as music promotion. One big shift, I think, is just in terms of the groupings in which you categorize music. Historically, I think largely because of physical limitations of both record stores and radio stations, everything is genre based. You have a radio station that plays, adult alternative or adult contemporary, and you have genre categories that define a certain set of music that sounds good together, and you have correspondingly categories in the record store for blues or whatever. And I think the reality is that for consumers, I think most consumers don't easily pigeonhole themselves into one genre. I mean, if I've asked hundreds of people, what kind of music do you like? A lot of times you get a blank stare back. Or people say, oh, I like all sorts of music. But if you really press them and say, no, what do you like? People say artist names. That's what their most rapidly comes to mind.
Yeah.
Oh, I like Jack Johnson and John Mayer, and I also like, Norah Jones or whatever. And you don't have in the physical world of, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, the ability to create a record store or radio station where the medium of organization is around artist names. Whereas I think with all of our services, Pandora being the most elegant one in this respect, it's only about the artist's name. Well, actually, Blast.fm has tags, which actually broaden it to kind of any, you know, you can make up your own genre with a tag. But, you know, the idea that I like this artist, therefore, essentially from one artist, you can have a whole grouping of similar sounding artists. I think that really changes the whole concept of music promotion. You know, because record labels have evolved around the idea that a certain new artist may or may not have a market because there's no market for that bucket of music. Like, you know, Norah Jones is a great example where, you know, I think it's a miracle that she got to where she did because no one would have expected there's a, such a big audience for that kind of jazz sound. There's not enough radio stations playing that music and not enough room on shelves and record stores for that kind of music. Yet clearly people do like it and, you know, she's now, you know, I think again, you know, coming out with a big hit this year. And I think the internet really creates that opening for types of music which might have been historically ignored because they didn't necessarily fit into a well-defined bucket. I think the other big trend, sorry for going on, but, you know, I think that for most consumers, you do, there's a value to having a tastemaker, somebody who you trust, telling you what to listen to. And historically, I think the radio station served that role, and maybe the guy at the record store. And I think that record labels have never really served that role. I mean, there's a few that have brands that you actually care about the music, but you don't think about, like, Universal Records. I'm going to buy the new Universal Records release.
Yeah, it's the great Sony sound.
Yeah, exactly. You don't think of it that way. What I think is interesting is you have services now that are developing that trust. I think Pandora has a phenomenal brand from that respect in terms of if Pandora recommends it to me, I'm probably going to like it in the same way you feel that way towards your local radio station.
Interestingly, Starbucks seems to have got some mojo there.
Starbucks does as well, yeah. Obviously, one of our goals is for our service, I like to develop the same sort of sense of trust. But I was talking about this because I think there's a really interesting other category that we haven't talked about enough on this panel, which is your group of friends. You mentioned that Pandora will never have a chart of what's listened to the most on Pandora, which I agree is kind of useless. But a service that I like offers is it shows you a chart of what's listened to the most amongst your friends. Mm. And in fact, you can also say, I just want to see what my most musically compatible friends are listening to. What have my musically compatible friends added to their iPods in the last week that I don't have? That kind of information is, I think, a phenomenal way to discover music, and it's placing that stamp of approval or that trusted source not on a record station, not on a record label or radio station or a record store, but on your circle of friends. Mm-hmm. I think for the 80-year-old person, they may be less likely to discover music through their friends, but certainly like the, you know, 12 to 25-year-old, you know, through your friends really is where you discover music. And even if you don't like their music, you have almost a social obligation to at least know what they're listening to. So you're not the one loser who's left out and has never heard of the artist. And for, you know, for whether it's social reasons or actual, you know, discovery, discovering music through your friends, I think, is a really important type of discovery that is neglected both by the algorithmic and by the, you know, and by the collaborative filtering mechanisms. Anyway, that's my spiel.
No, it's true. And I mean, community is incredibly important. And, you know, maybe you listen to some goth music and you're from, you know, Minnesota and nobody there listens to goth music. But if you go on Last.fm, you can find other users that share your taste. So, I mean, it's a good point. Community is incredibly valuable.
I think Tom and Ali really hit onto the right points there. I think it's very much about personalization, the possibility now to tailor-make programs for people individually, go away from this one-size-fits-all broadcast model where you just play out the same old stuff. Yeah. And this is why most of the normal radio stations and MTV cannot really take risks anymore. They're not really breaking artists anymore. There's nothing new being played because they have to play their middle-of-the-road sort of like music that nobody is really offended by. I think it's our obligation, for who we are sitting here, just to break this and make sure that music is accessible for you first and foremost. It's about availability, and that's where I really differ with Tom, because I really think, like, there is, if somebody created it, there is somebody out there that wants to listen to it, even if it's only 100 people, but there are out there, most likely. And through this personalized way of discovery, it is possible now to connect these people with this sort of music. So it's going away from the broadcast.
Fortunately. we won't make you only listen to Pandora. See, so he's not saying you can't find other stuff.
No, no. I failed to mention in my description about Pandora, our wonderful mashup. No, Pandora FM is a really great thing, whereby you can listen to Pandora and scroll everything into your Last FM profile.
Yeah, and I'll tell you a story about that. We did that with this guy named Gabe Rivera in Chicago. He had put something together that was a bit of a hackish abomination, and we called him up and we said, we think Last is a great service, and we'd love to work with you to do this in a way that's sustainable for us. And so, you know, absolutely, we're enthusiastic about taking our, you know, the work that we do to craft great playlists and filter it, send it right into Last. And I think that is emblematic of the era that we're in right now, where a lot of technology companies are worried less about sort of protecting their IP and more about solving problems for consumers. And I would love to connect Pandora up to people's Last FM profile feeds, suggest stations in the context of Pandora based on the things they're listening to in iTunes. And I don't know if Martin wants to say that's fine up here, but
no, we can have a look.
But we think that would be
yes.
There was a turnover to these guys.
Yeah, line of people there.
Indeed, we should look at this hungry line. All right.
Hey, how's it going? Steve Poland with TechCrunch. I just had a couple questions. Obviously, like Steve Jobs comes out and says, you know, out of an iPod that's got 60 million or, you know, 60 gigs, that only 2% of that is legal. So they're on average selling like 22 songs, and yet their data shows that those are typically 100% filled. So 98% is still illegal. This might
Wait. I mean, certainly it's fair use to rip CDs that you bought and put them on your iPod.
CDs. Correct. I'm curious, and maybe this is more towards Last. You're obviously probably seeing a lot of pirated tracks coming through, probably tagged with various, you know, wares, whatever it is. Do you have any stats on how much coming through you is pirated?
Metadata doesn't give you problems.
We don't know, and we don't want to know. We don't really care.
Yeah, I'll ditto that. We have the same access to similar data. I would confirm that only about 2-3% of people's libraries are files they bought on the iTunes Music Store. You can identify that because it's protected AAC, which there's only one company that can sell that. But of the other 97%, I don't even know if there's any obvious way to track whether it's a CD that they ripped or a CD that someone else ripped that they then got copied, you know, the MP3. If I rip my own CD to MP3,
yeah,
it's a legal copy for me. If then 200 other people get it from me, you know, it's questionable whether it's legal or not, but there's no difference in the file, so there's no way to tell.
The licensing dimensions around all of the radio services are complicated and interesting. We paid several million dollars last year in licensing fees for the music that we played on Pandora, 50% of which goes directly to artists, the other half goes to the labels. We paid hundreds of thousands more to publishers for the songwriters. So, you know, we're at Pandora from the, you know, a company of musicians ourselves and are really passionate about participating in the financial ecosystem that enables people to give their life over to music creation and performance. So,
I don't know if you were hinting a little bit at the DRM issue as well. I think the DRM issue as a whole is just holding back the market. No wonder that only 2% of stuff is purchased from iTunes Music Store, because it's a great user experience when you buy it, but a few months later, you find out that you can't copy it anymore and things like this. So this is massively hampering the market. There would be a lot more purchased music on the iPods if that would fall.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Ditto.
Yeah.
Next question here.
Hey. Someone want to stand up and defend DRM?
No. My name is Aaron Baker. My LastFM username is Helvetica Man. But the question is for Pandora. What's the diversity like on your ivory tower, so to speak? How many people, and what are their backgrounds, and how does that affect what they classify as what? And then I guess the question for the other guys is, what does your data gathering process tell you about people and how people are grouped based on what they listen to?
In terms of the diversity of the music analysts, there are about 50 of them. They work like kind of two-thirds time. The one thing that they have in common is that they're all professional musicians. We have singers and songwriters and drummers and piccolo players. The music that we currently sort of support in the system is pop and country and electronica and rap and jazz and Latin music. We seek out people who are experts in each of those domains. We hire people specifically for their expertise and knowledge about hip hop, for example. We've hired native Sanish people, speakers for our analyzing our Latin collection. We're working on a classical collection, and we've hired people to come from classical performance. So it's one of the best things about working at Pandora is getting to work every day with the fine musicians that are part of the company. Fun fact, bass player for the Decemberists was a music analyst at Pandora for many years.
You had a question about data gathering, and I'll address it from our perspective. Music IP goes a little different route than the guys who log metadata. We actually use what's called an acoustic fingerprint to identify specific tracks, but we throw away the IP address. We make everything ruthlessly anonymous because we don't want to violate anyone's privacy. There's still a lot of aggregate data there that's quite interesting, but we'll never be able to attach it to you.
And I think the data that you gather, if you know what music a person likes, you essentially know a lot about them. And has shown, Last.fm has facilitated several marriages already, several people hooked up to get
great.
Married based on the music
test.
I personally don't know if a shared music taste is a great basis for a relationship, but some people do.
The hell to start.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any way to make a general answer to such a broad question as what have we learned about people. What's interesting, I Like gets a similar type of data as Last.fm of watching what you're listening to. We get a lot more data the moment you install the software because we actually get a copy of your entire iTunes.xml log file, which includes your past listening history. So essentially, if you've been listening to music on that computer for 5 years, we get all your historical scrabbles, I guess, rather than just starting from the point you install it. And what I don't know whether this is pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised, but essentially it was interesting to see quite how popular the Beatles and Radiohead are. I thought those might be because Last.fm originated in the UK that was so big on their side, but they're incredibly popular everywhere. I mean, we started out in the Bay Area and Seattle and spread from that direction, and we've had to kind of write special code to try to prevent the Beatles from popping up everywhere, essentially. You like this obscure thing? Well, you'll also like the Beatles. People who like anything also like the Beatles, basically. So, it's amazing. And I think the Radiohead one is the more interesting of those. I mean, Beatles is not a big surprise, but Radiohead, compared to their, I think, they're much, much bigger than you might realize from looking at mainstream media, I think.
I think we only have time for a few more questions, but... Maybe we can be quick here.
Sure, guys. All of your services are fantastic. I use all four of them, actually. You've clearly put a lot of time into the user experience and discovering music, that stuff. But I was hoping you could talk for a minute about your business models and making money from music, which seems to be a little bit more of a difficult question, especially with the new licensing for streaming media and how that's affecting Pandora.
I'm interested just as much to know how you make money as do the artists.
Sure.
And how, if per se, Radiohead is increasing your traffic and you're able to then receive more money from advertising, does any of that go back to Radiohead?
Sure.
I mean, similar situation to what Tom described before. As soon as you play music, obviously you have to pay all the people involved in creating the music, the songwriters, as much as the record labels, as much as the performers, something that is maybe peculiar to you, particular to Europe, but in Europe also you have to pay the performers, every little cymbal player that played on the music. Last.fm traditionally makes money out of e-commerce sales. We sell a lot of music through Amazon, through CDs, through download stores. We sell concert tickets. Things like this, and a percentage of that revenue goes back to the artists, the record labels, and the performers. Additionally, we have a lot of advertising on our site. The site is extremely popular, and advertising doesn't need much thinking about in that sense to capitalize the website.
Yeah, in terms of our business model, 99% of the radio listening in, is ad-supported free in the terrestrial world. Our service is ad-supported free as well. We've had a really successful year selling display advertising on the site. We have a great team dedicated to doing that. We have 11 people who do nothing but sell advertising because, you know, us getting paid is what allows artists to get paid. And every song that we play, there's a royalty that goes to the publisher, to the performer, and to the label. We paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars to rights holders and performers and publishers over the course of the last 2 years. And, you know, part of what we hope we can help facilitate is a kind of environment that creates a system where you can make a living being a performer, create kind of a working middle class for musicians, so you don't have to either be, you know, starving or a mega star, that there can be a way to have a life as a performer. And we think that there's an opportunity emerging around that in the new digital music space, and we hope to be a big part of that.
Yeah. Our business models different from the other three in that we're, as a technology licensee, we look for customers. This is an MP3 player with a music discovery engine in it. You push a button, make a playlist. It's actually produced by Disney, and Disney licensed the technology from us. So from that perspective, very different business model than these other guys.
We're still working out where the revenue is going to come from. We have a few different ideas. I mean, we do expect that there's going to be revenue, I mean, primarily in advertising, but does that mean advertising from a McDonald's? We hope not. Is it, you know, so essentially we're hoping to make money from advertising that is music related. We think there's in particular money in concert promotion. And, you know, if we know that you're a fan of Prince and Prince is about to go on tour, we, you know, for us to tell you that Prince is going on tour is a service to you and also something we can get paid for. So that's an area in particular that we're hoping to spend a lot of effort exploiting. On the question regarding artist royalties, on our site, when I mentioned how popular Radiohead is, it's in terms of we're measuring the number of times people have listened to it on their iTunes or on their iPod. People are not coming to iLike to play Radiohead quite so much. In fact, we don't offer full song plays other than for songs which artists have given us the right to play and to redistribute free MP3s. So if an artist has given us a free MP3, then we redistribute it and we try to give it as wide an audience as possible. And part of the deal is the artist agrees to waive any royalties associated with it. For everything else, we only play 30-second samples. We do pay royalties for the 30-second samples, which hopefully some part of that finds its way to the artists. But we're not primarily a destination for coming and listening to music for 5 hours. It's for coming in and seeing, here's the five songs that you don't own that you got to get, and then we'll link to Amazon or to iTunes to buy them. I personally don't think there's a lot of money for us, certainly, to be made in the music retail side. Yeah. I'm not even sure there's much money, unfortunately, for anyone, frankly. You know, the labels are barely breaking even. Obviously, it's, you know, well-known kind of that most artists don't make a lot of money off sales of their music. It's a selling recorded music is a tough business for anyone to make money in. You know, sales of iPods and sales of flat screen TVs at Target, those are the things that make money off of recorded music.
Yep.
But we do help connect people to their favorite artists in other ways, and I think artists are increasingly realizing that they need to make money through a combination of touring and merchandise sales and, you know, other revenue sources besides just the sale of recorded music. And if we help you go to a concert by your favorite artist or even by an unknown artist that, you know, we recommend, that I think does help build revenue for the artist as well.
Yeah, I think we have to pretty much cut it there. But you should come up and ask questions directly afterwards if you have any further questions.
I just have a really quick question. This will probably be like a yes or no thing, but do all of your services work on OS X?
Yes.
Yes.
Work what?
On OS X, yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
I want to thank everybody here. It's a pleasure to be involved with this.
All right, now I'm going to go smack some.